If you will, turn to James chapter 3, James chapter 3. As you're turning there, I want you to think about, sometimes the book of James is called the Proverbs of the New Testament, because it has a lot to say about wisdom and very practical things. And if we think about the book of Proverbs, what is the main message of the book of Proverbs? Okay, we want to seek after wisdom, right? And so tonight in chapter 3 of the book of James, we'll talk about wisdom. Because when we look in the book of Proverbs, how many types of wisdom, if that's the right way to say it, do we find in the book of Proverbs? What? Yeah, it's just seek after wisdom, find wisdom. Wisdom is very valuable. Make great efforts to find it. But in James chapter 3, we discover that there's actually another type of wisdom. So let's look at this. James chapter 3 and verse 13. It says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice." And then the next verses will talk about what we normally think about when we say wisdom. So where does this bad type of wisdom come from? It comes from the world, okay? He says in verse 15, it's earthly, unspiritual, demonic. So whatever he's talking about here, what would be an example of this kind of earthly or demonic wisdom? What would you think would qualify as that type of wisdom? Okay, could be wisdom of the Pharisees. All right. So why do you think James, and behind James the Holy Spirit, would call this, which is not very good, why would he call it wisdom? Okay. That's right. So same thing as Paul saying, I'm shocked that you've turned to another gospel. There's not really another gospel, but so this would have the appearance of wisdom. It would have the appearance of being something very valuable, but it turns out it's not very good. And he's going to give us some of the impact or the effect of it. Look at verse 16. "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice." How do you think that is connected to this earthly or this bad type of wisdom? What's the connection between that wisdom and this verse 16? Yeah, we might say that, just sort of use an example, somebody might say, to be successful in business, you need to be willing to lie, to cheat, to be dishonest. And let's just assume that's true. And that would advance you in business. Would that be the right type of wisdom? It's wisdom that might help us in our career, but as Trevor said, it has no thought towards the next life, toward God. And so this is a type of wisdom we want to avoid. So just because something has some earthly value does not mean that it has heavenly value. And so let's switch gears now. Look at verse 17. "But the wisdom from above is," and then he's going to give a bunch of characteristics. "First pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere." We're not going to spend much time, but let's look at each of these words. And I'm reading from the ESV. What would pure be? Because he says first it would be pure, this heavenly type of wisdom. It's perfect. Okay. You know, we might say something is maybe it's some type of jewelry or something, we say this is pure, or there's no taint to it. Well, this type of wisdom is perfect. Now, what about peaceable? What does that tell you about the wisdom from above as opposed to the wisdom from earth? Who will it bring peace with? Okay. Yeah, definitely between God and man, right? If we follow this wisdom. And it should bring peace between men. Now, sometimes we see that even with Jesus, there were men that rejected Jesus. But this should bring peace between everybody. But we know it'll definitely bring peace between us and God. What about gentle? Why would heavenly wisdom be described as gentle? Okay. A tenderness, compassion. And when we back up to verse 16, as opposed to jealousy, selfish ambition, disorder, every vile practice, there's a major contrast here. Then, this is an interesting expression, open to reason. What do some of the other versions say? Reasonable, okay? So reasonable, able to reason or be reasoned with or hear, open to reason. Okay, willing to yield. Justin? He stole your... Yeah. So what does this mean about open to reason or willing to yield? How does heavenly wisdom relate to that? What's the connection there? Okay. So Alan has kind of summed this up by taking us back to, what is it, chapter 1 that says, be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Unless we have those three characteristics, it's going to be very hard for us to be reasonable or able to reason, open to reason. And he says, willing to yield the heavenly wisdom. That's the opposite of the earthly wisdom that might say, it's all about me. It's about my ego, my pride, my success. No, this is saying, be willing to yield. And then this full of mercy and good fruits. Why would heavenly wisdom produce in us this idea of being full of mercy and good fruits? Okay. God shows us the best example of mercy. And so if we're following that example, the wisdom from above, then we would be full of mercy and good fruits. And then impartial. Well, we've already talked about that in, what, chapter 2? We don't want to show partiality. And sincere. So this is not something where we might say, well, earthly wisdom tells me to pretend to like Chris because that'll be some advantage to me, even though I don't like the guy at all. You know, I really do like him. But this saying, be sincere. Whatever you're doing, be sincere. There's no acting or hypocrisy. This is, we should be exactly who we're supposed to be. Yeah, and this is, you know, we've talked about with the book of James. It's a challenging book. Not so much in the sense that we don't know what it means, but we know what it means. Now we've got to do it. And we could spend a lot of time just on verse 17. Say, let me go through these characteristics. As Stephen pointed out, some of them are inwardly focused. And then we see the result or the fruit of that in our lives. Trevor? Okay. And look at verse 18. And you can tell me how this is worded in maybe the New American Standard. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. How does that read in maybe New American Standard or New King James? What do you make of this verse? There's something about harvesting righteousness, sowing in peace by those who make peace. How do you put all that together in this verse? Yeah, so if we are doing what we're supposed to, and we're peacemakers as described in the Beatitudes, then if I can say it this way, the crop that we will harvest is going to be good things. Now, the opposite would be true. If we are sowing things not in peace, well, then we shouldn't be shocked when the crop is not a good crop. Did you have thoughts, Steve? Yeah, and so Stephen has made the point that we can certainly look at the abuses of the Pharisees and say, those are good people to look at and do the opposite. Because they were focused on themselves, they were focused on their position, their rank in society. And we have all these things in the New Testament about how, for example, how would they pray in public? Loud and long, okay? Now, there's nothing wrong with praying loud. There's nothing wrong with doing long prayers if those are sincere. But what was the reason that the Pharisees would pray loud and long? Because I want you to look at me. Okay? And so we do the opposite of that, and that would put us in pretty good shape there. Any final thoughts about chapter 3 before we move into chapter 4? Yeah, so Alan's made the point, we look at this earthly wisdom, it's all about me. See, if somebody has something I don't want, then I get jealous. And I'm going to do whatever it takes for me to succeed or for me to have whatever I want. And that's not the picture that God paints for us that He wants. All right, let's look in number 4, chapter 4. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. These first three verses, what is he getting at with these? Because if we just look at it on the surface, he says, you desire, do not have, so you murder, you covet, so you fight, you don't have because you don't ask, you do ask, but you don't receive. Well, what's the point of all this? Yeah, if it's all about me, then that's going to ultimately cause problems. Because if it's all about me, and all of you have the same approach, it's all about you, are we going to coexist very nicely in life? No, there's going to be conflict. There's going to be anger. There's going to be divisions. Because we're all fighting for the number one spot. And so he goes through verse 2. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you don't ask. You ask but do not receive because you ask wrongly. Spend on your passions. Then look at verse 4. You adulterous people. Now, is he saying that the folks I'm describing in verses 1 through 3 have committed adultery in their marriage? Is that what he's talking about? Okay. Say that again, Trey. Okay. Yeah. So why is he using pretty strong language here about murder and adultery, which kind of reminds us of maybe a chapter or two back? But why use that type of language if they literally were not murdering people, literally were not committing adultery? Why use that language? Yeah, it's a little bit shocking, okay? I mean, he's going through talking about, you're not at peace and you're fighting over your passions. And by the way, you're a murderer and adulterer. Whoa. And so this does get their attention. Yes, sir. Yeah, so these terms of adultery, murder, they are shocking terms to get our attention. And they also are true, not in a physical sense, but if we're not faithful to God, and we're supposed to be in a covenant relationship with God, well then, how else do we describe that? We're committing adultery. Just like Israel, we think of, who's the prophet that, you know, some of these prophets had a really hard time. God would give them some commands and there's this one prophet and he had to marry this woman and she would cheat on him. And who was that? Hosea. Now that was a hard mission that guy had. But it's to be a visual aid, an example of what's going on. So look at we'll finish verse 4. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Now, without delving too deeply into this, just at sort of the surface level, if somebody says, would you like to be an enemy of God? What is your just knee-jerk reaction to that? No. Okay. Now, we don't say, well, we have to really psychoanalyze all the facts. No. An enemy of God, not a good place to be. Historically, from the beginning of time, and we know through the end of time, what's the success rate of being an enemy of God? Zero. If we look at the book of Revelation, what are we told about the ultimate outcome of this battle between God, Jesus, and His enemies? Who wins? Jesus wins. So we know from the beginning of time through the end of time, if you're an enemy of God, you lose. So why would we say, I think today I'll become an enemy of God? Why would we do that? Okay, lost our mind. Now, do we typically say, we wake up one morning and we go, I think it's a good day to be an enemy of God. Do we say those words in our minds? Well, then how can we become an enemy of God? Yeah, so we have these internal desires, and we're told in chapter 1 those desires ultimately give birth to sin, and then there's death. And so it's not so much that we wake up one morning and say, I want to be an enemy of God. But we find ourselves being a friend of the world. Now, can we say to God, look, I'm a friend to the world, but I'm not your enemy. Is that an option here? We say, but I want to be both. I want to be a friend to the world and a friend to God. What would God say to that? Yeah, so we have to choose. Now, we might say, but I really would like both. But Jesus, the creator of the universe, says, you pick one. You can pick me or you can pick the other, but you got to pick. And so here James is simply saying, if we are a friend of the world, then we have chosen to be an enemy of God. Look at verse 5. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the scripture says he yearns jealously over the spirit that he has made to dwell in us? But he gives us more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. What is this talking about? Yearns jealously over his spirit. What is that? I thought jealousy was bad, Trevor. Okay. Not always. This type of jealousy is not bad because God is jealous for us. He wants our affection. He wants us to look to him. We see in the Old Testament when they would serve idols and give the praise and the credit to idols, what did that do to God's emotions? Kindled his anger. Just set it on fire. He's a jealous God. And so we have here that he's jealous, and if we are a friend to the world, an enemy of God, then we are just kindling or setting a fire to his anger against us. Probably not a good idea, I would suggest. What about this idea of grace? But he gives more grace, therefore God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. What's the connection in this context between being proud and being humble? Right, and that's important because if we go back a few verses, we have this earthly wisdom and it's jealousy, and that's a bad thing, but this is a godly type jealousy. But what's this idea between being proud and being humble? Okay, very good. Even Ahab, right? Yeah, so if you missed that Sunday night, we talked about Ahab, this horrible king, and God pronounces a judgment on him. And it's not, well, I might do, it's, this is happening. And then Ahab, shockingly, humbles himself. And it's almost like God says to, is it Elijah? Says to Elijah, do you see what Ahab did? Do you see how he humbled himself? It's almost like God is kind of amazed by this. And he says, okay, well, I won't bring this in his lifetime, but in his son's lifetime. So if Ahab can do that, and there was a king that I think he was kind of a bad king. His name was Manasseh. Do we remember that guy? Pretty bad, like the streets of Jerusalem are running with rivers of blood because of this guy. And he's taken away and he prays to God. And what does God do to this horrible, horrible king? Yeah, and then he ultimately restores him. And then we see this guy, Manasseh, trying to do what's right. And so we have this idea that if we will humble ourselves, then good things will happen. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think that's right. We have that sort of clear arrogance, as Brad mentioned, where some king says, who is God to stand before me? All right, that's not going to end well. But yet, if we take God from up here, put him down here, and we elevate other things, in a sense, that's the same thing. And God doesn't like that either. Look at verse 7. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, when he talks about the devil, is this a metaphor? This is just symbolizing temptation? Or is there a literal being that's the devil? What now? There's a being. Yeah, we're told Satan, devil. I mean, there's different ways to describe him. But this is not just some psychological construct in our mind. This is a real entity. And what is his mission in life for you personally? What is his mission in life towards you, Stan? Cause you to fall. Now, does this verse say that he might at some point come after you? Yeah, he's definitely coming after you. Now, if you resist the devil, then what will the devil do? Flee. So that raises two questions for it. How do we resist the devil? And then what does that mean to flee? So let's start with probably the most important one. How do we resist the devil? Okay. Follow God. How else would we resist the devil? Is that the other hand? We're like working all your sermons into this class. Yeah, this is our tools against the devil. We learn what God's word is. We learn what his will is. And then that gives us, if we'll execute on it. Now remember, knowledge is not enough. We learned that in chapter 1. Mere knowledge of the Bible, that's worthless. Knowledge that we put into practice is priceless. And that's going to help us to resist the devil. Todd, did you have a comment? Okay. Trevor? What's our motivation to put away all these things that obviously we're attracted to, or we wouldn't have them in the first place? What's the motivation to push those away to be able to embrace God? Yeah, it's anything in life. Why do we choose this food versus that food? Why do we go here on vacation instead of there? Watch this show instead of that show? Because ultimately we say, I like this one more, or this will avoid pain for me. And so with God, God gives us both motivation. Does God tell us the wonderful pleasure we will get if we're faithful to Him? Sure. heaven, right? Mansion, I mean, no tears. Does he tell us the unbelievable pain we will experience if we turn our back on God? And what's that called? Hell. Yeah. I don't know how he can make it more graphic. You know, we talked about before, you got this fire and darkness, how those coexist. You've got worms that don't die even though you're on fire. I mean, I don't know how he can make it any more horrible than that. And that gives us the motivation to say, what Trevor's talking about, push this stuff away. We push these idols away. Because this is what I want, not going to hell. Brad, how much time do we have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. So verse 8, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. So again, the same concept that we have to humble ourselves and then God will exalt us. Jesus gave a story one time or some advice. He said, if you go to a dinner party, here's where you should not sit. Where was that? Yeah, the chief seat or the place of honor. And he said, here's the reason you shouldn't do that, because what might happen? Stan, I need you to move down there. Okay. Instead, where should you sit? Yeah, you go sit over there and then let the head of the party or whatever say, hey, come up here. Now, was Jesus just taking a little break from explaining the gospel and said, let me give you some good practical advice when you go eat dinner with people? Was that his purpose? What's the spiritual lesson of that? Humble yourself. Yeah, so he's just using a physical example here to say, if you exalt yourself, you can be brought down. If you humble yourself, you'll be brought up. Now, we've hit this in several different ways tonight. Why so much in the Bible about being humble as opposed to being proud? Okay. Yeah, once I allow pride in, then it's very, very difficult for good things to happen. I think you got the last comment. Well said. If pride is idolatry and I'm the idol in that sin, and then that opens up everything. So thank you for your thoughts and comments. Brad will teach Sunday and he will go at his complete discretion on pace. But I'd say be ready for chapter 4 and 5, and there may still be some lessons back there.